I caught up with Len at the Grace Hotel in Sydney recently.
I'd walk through that door in 1943. The second time I'd walked through that door was 75 years later. Today is the third time.
And that's three quarters of a century.
Yeah. General MacArthur took this hotel over. It wasn't a hotel, it was a building of some description. And he made that into his headquarters. That's where the small ships were formed. But I come through those doors and they diverted me down to the small six section. That's where I joined up.
Do you remember how you felt that day when you walked through those doors?
Well, I was on an old coal ship, dirty old coal ship, and I knew from other seamen that had told me about it, you'd be better off joining the United States small ships. He said they're looking for seamen, experienced seamen. And I said, well, I'll go down. I was in the Newcastle Harbour when I heard about this. And I said, well, where do I find out about it? And they said, well, you've got to go down to Sydney. It's about an hour's run down by train. And I got on the train and come down here. In those days, Sydney was only a small place. We only had, 5 million people in the whole of Australia. How I got here, I don't know. But I got here and walked through those doors down there. And that's how it all started. Within a week or two, I'm back in New Guinea and then down to Oro Bay in New Guinea. And they put me on a ship in New Guinea. That's how it all started.
And Len, last time we spoke, we finished off where you had been to Shanghai way back in, 1945?
Yes, shortly after the war finished, the ship I was on went in to Tokyo and no one was allowed ashore until the peace treaty was signed. But when it was finally signed, I was eligible for repatriation back to Australia, but the captain says the ship's going to be handed over to the United Nations and we would like you to stay on and take it to Shanghai. We should think about it for an hour or two. He said, we'd like you to stay. I think they would find it hard to get a replacement. So I stayed with them and I went into Shanghai. And it was one of the first ships to go in, if not the first, one of the first ships to go into Shanghai with UNRWA, United Nations Relief Organization. I seen China, unbelievably, it was bad, starvation, people every morning, they were picking up the bodies in the shop, destroyed, everything was destroyed, no water, no food. Terrible, and it's had an effect on me. Terrible effect. And recently we've seen it on the ABC, the Shanghai, and Denise, my daughter, said, would you like to go back and have a look at it? And I said, as a matter of fact, I would. And that's how Barry and Denise and Suzanne, they organised it, see. And it's been marvellous to go back and look at it. How they advanced and everything is totally different and it's all gone ahead. Where I find that here in Australia we've been stationary, whereas they've gone ahead. They're well-dressed, they look well, they're healthy. Everything surprised me to see it. I was very pleased to see that the trip was very, very interesting. And I come away and now that's gone out of my mind, you know, the death and destruction. I've seen a lot of death and destruction all through the islands, but that was through the effects of war, not through starvation, you know. No water, no food. But when I come away from Shanghai this time, it's all dissolved in my mind. How they've done it, I don't know, but they've done it, and they've done a good job. Their roads, their buildings, the high-rises, you know, the high-rise houses. Unbelievable to see it.
So, Lynn, that's given you closure on that period of your life.
Yes, it has, yes. I think now I feel a lot better. You know, I've seen it. The people have advanced to such an extent that they're all healthy and they're all... and friendly, you know. The two differences, as I've seen it, when I went into Japan, they didn't want to know me. No one would look at me. No one would speak to me. No one. But when I went to China now, the other day, just recently, they're all friendly as anything. They all want to know more about Australia, you know what I mean? They're all coming up, taking photos of us. A very interesting thing is, my daughter took along about a dozen or two dozen little koalas, whereas I was handing out food in the old days. Well, I was handing out a few koalas, just nice little kids, and it was marvellous to see the how they responded. We'd see the mother with a little kitty, and we'd go over and get the little, and then the grandmother would, the mother, and the, we'd have two or three generations would come and want to know where we come from and all, everything. It was interesting, very interesting.
And you were there coinciding with the period of Anzac Day.
Ah, yes, yes. I don't know how it happened. We were staying in a very nice hotel. That was in Beijing, shortly after we arrived there. And my daughter got the phone call, and they said that their staff car arrived at 4 o'clock in the morning to pick us up. And I'm not telling you a lie, they took us every bit of 45 kilometres or so from one side of Beijing to the other, where the consuls were there, various consuls. And it was marvellous to see them. And they give us a VI treatment, and we laid a wreath for the small ship section there. We have numerous photographs that we'll show you later on of it. It was marvellous. The staff car waited there all day for until we finished. They put a marvellous show on. There was, I don't know how many consuls were there, but numerous ones, including the Turkish consul, New Zealand, various others. American, I can't recall his name, but a Brigadier General of the United States Army. He was familiar with the American side of the small ships, but not familiar with the Australian section. And he wanted to know all about, for a good hour or more after the service was over, he was there talking to us, wanting to find out more about the 3,300 or so Australians that were recruited, you know, old folk, too old for the army, or others that were too young for the army, like myself. But it was a marvellous day, marvellous day. And I'll never forget it, as long as I live. I'll never forget it.
Fabulous. Well, I have another surprise for you. Just hang on just a moment.
I handed Len some Japanese occupation money, a generous gift to him from South Australian World War II veteran Colin Wagoner. Colin obtained it in Labuan in 1945 at the surrender of Japanese General Maseo Barber.
The last I seen that, when we went into Manila was terribly destroyed. Banks blown to pieces. This was blowing, not only this, a lot of other currencies too. Occasionally you would find Australian notes or Indian or various other nationalities, but this here was plentiful, that would be blown along the road, and I picked up a lot of it, just as this here, and I can tell you without even looking at it, the Japanese government promises to pay the bearer on demand the sum of 1 shilling or half a pound and things like that. I had the same collection as I can see it. Yeah.
This one is slightly different in that it doesn't say the Japanese government agrees to pay the bearer on demand. This is Japanese occupation of Australia money.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. This is what they would use in American occupied countries or the Philippines. And the strange thing was, it says Japanese government promises to pay the bearer on the man. It didn't say 10 shillings. It says, I think it said half a pound or something like that. You know, it is occupational money. Yeah, I'll just. That 50 centavos, that was used in the Philippines,
yes.
Centavos. That's what they would have used in America, just the same as they had it printed for Australia. They carried it. Is that all right?
Yes, absolutely.
Good. 10, 50, 10. Yeah, there's 3 good ones. Thank you very much. I probably might see the Philippines again. I'll show some of the Filipinos. We're talking about going to the Isle of Skye. My ancestors come from the Isle of Skye. My great-great-grandfather, he was arrested because they reckon he stole a sheep, and he was sent to Tasmania. Denise will tell you, because she's been over there and read the whole history of it in Scotland. I think he ended up doing about 10 years in hard labour in Tasmania. But his story was he didn't steal it, the sheep jumped the fence, you know. Things must have been pretty hard up, and he got caught. But anyhow, he was a convict. And they went over there in Scotland, and they'd done the research on it and found that he had a hard time over there. Well, they want to go back. They're talking about going back in September. I don't know whether I could see the 20 hours or so flight on the plane, but otherwise, if I keep going the way I am, I might.
Have you ever been to Scotland at all?
No. I've never been to Europe. I've travelled extensively in the Pacific, all around the Pacific. I've worked in the Pacific. I've done numerous contracts, Bougainville, various places like that. I do 6 months or 12 months contract, and I travelled all over the Pacific. You name it, I've been there, but I've never been in Europe. Japan, China and the Pacific, but it's as far as I've been. But in a way, they've been there and they'd like me to see it.
The Clan MacLeod have what they call a Clan Parliament every 4 years.
Yeah.
They had one last year. There's going to be a worldwide Clan MacLeod gathering in South Australia.
South Australia.
You'll have to come.
Yeah. Well, 12 months ago, when I come here to this building, I promised them I'd come back this year. I don't know whether I can make that promise. Like Bob Hawkins, you know Bob. I knew Bob well too. I met Bob through the unions and things like that. I was mixed up in the unions as a young fella in the Latrobe Valley. They all knew me. and Bob knew me well. But I always thought Bob was 2 or 3 years older than me, but it's only recently, you know, when I said in the paper, that I was 3 years older than Bob. So I'm doing pretty well. I should have not be here because I've been in that many scrapes and got out of it. I've been lucky, extremely lucky, for various things. I think I told you on there that the ship I was on, we could not maintain the speed in the convoy, a 104 ship convoy going into Leyte in the Philippines. And we were the second, when we set off from New Guinea, northern part of New Guinea, we formed up into a 104 ship convoy, and we were the second ship on the starboard side of maybe 10 ships, or I don't know how many, but was behind us, but there was about 5 to 7 or 8 rows of ships, and we couldn't maintain because of the type of ship we had, and we dropped back and dropped back and dropped back until we dropped out. I think if we'd have stayed in that position, I wouldn't have been here to tell you the story, because that was where the Americans, I think the Japanese lost something like about 130 planes in 24 hours. One of the last big battles, in the Battle of Leyte. And then we went into the Philippines. Well, Japan was starting to be well on the way of being defeated then. But then we went into just off Japan, when they dropped the atomic bombs. And I'm very lucky to be here. You know.
Len, you were meant to be here. Circumstances dictated it.
I showed Len some photos that Colin Wagner had taken during the Japanese surrender at Labuan in 1945. It included a photo of the only 3 English prisoner of war survivors, terribly emaciated.
For us to carry a camera was illegal. I had some friends too that died in Singapore. You know, they're captured in Singapore.
Yes.
They starved, starved to death, just like that. Good friends of mine, you know. 20,000 Australians captured in Singapore. 20,000, the whole 8th Division.
I know.
You never hear them mention about the 8th Division. Of the whole 20,000, I don't think there was 3,000 got out of it, you know. It was terrible, terrible.
And there were women and children as well.
Oh, that was all. What they could collect, whatever they could. No, these were fit army personnel. When I first went to New Guinea, I was in the for a while, for several months, I'd done the biscuit bombing. And then I lost 2 good mates. 9 of us would take off, 9 C-47s. When they got up, 3, 3, and 3, like that, in close formation, you could almost jump from the tail of one to the wing tip of the other. Just not much further than the width of this room. That's how close they'd fly together. 3 planes, but we were escorted by several fighter planes. And we dropped all over New Guinea at various times. We'd all get one, they'd circle around, and it would take anywhere between 5 and 8 drops to get your load out. At 5 times, they'd go down treetop level, and then up, we'd get out as much as we could, push it out. And they'd circle around and go down one after the other, about 1/2 mile apart. On our way back one day, I'm sitting there, sitting back. We'd done our drop. We're on our way back to Port Moresby. And I look out the plane, out the little windows, and there's one over there, should have been there, one missing. I look around. No, there's only 8 of us. 3, 3, and 2. But I thought, I didn't pay any attention to it. But they were dropping with us, as it turned out. But see, I never seen anything that we dropped because we were busy, you know, getting it out. Slide it out, the two doors would be thrown on the ground and left on the ground. And my hearing is down a little bit because of that too, the noise. I found out later that nearly all the biscuit bombers, their hearing's down, mine's down a bit. And I didn't pay any attention, you know. I thought, oh, well, he's been away. This sometimes this happened because they'd drop in various other places. We went out, but usually always when we got back near Port Moresby, the nine would be together. Anyhow, when I got ashore, about an hour ashore, the pilots never told me anything. And I'm just waiting for the plane to come in and land and everything with me other fellas. About an hour ashore, one of the fellas said to me, he said, what happened to one of your planes? I said, what do you mean, one of you happened? And he said, oh, he said, one's gone down. And he said, yeah, he said, one's missing. I just forget the name. I think it was Skindy Y, but I'm only guessing now, was the name of the part of New Guinea that we were dropping at that particular time. A village. But about a month later, I'm in the camp there at Moresby, and I hear them talking about something about a plane was crashed. So I go over and I listen carefully, and this fella said, yeah, he said, I witnessed it, just like that. Then I paid particular attention then, and I went over and I said, well, listen, where was it? And blah, blah, blah. And I knew then that it was our plane, one of our planes. And he said, yeah, he said, you were dropping to us coming in. He said, but they'd put 2 4-gallon drums of biscuits and bully beef. We dropped a hell of a lot of that. Tins of bully beef in bags. Everything was in bags. Potato sacks, heavy duty potato sacks, and tied up. And they'd put 2 4-gallon drums in a potato sack and tie it up. But the biscuits were pretty light. And we were told and trained, when the green lights come on, push it out. When the red light comes on, stop, don't do anything, because they're rising up, see. Obviously what happened, this is what the young soldier was told me, he said the plane had to turn because it was down a valley and had to turn quickly to get out. Had to rise and turn to get out, to swing around, to come back to do another drop. Well, what happened, that tins of biscuits flew back, got caught in the elevator and the tail. You know, you got one part where it goes up and one part, and comes, as he's turned, it jammed in between, and the pilot wouldn't have known why, see? If he'd have known why, he could have probably shifted the rudder part or the elevator part. But he didn't know why, and he's approaching a mountain and he's trying his hardest to turn around, and over it went, straight over, and they were all killed. That was the 2 droppers who'd volunteered the same day as I did, and the co-pilot, the pilot, and the radio operator. There was 5 on the plane when it went down. Well, I kept on dropping for another couple of weeks. And then I said to them about the crack battalion come from the Middle East back to the 7th Battalion. had just come back from the Middle East, straight to New Guinea. And I heard about it, and I said, what about going back to the infantry? I said, you can send me to the 7th Battalion if you like. He said, that's easy done. And he transferred me to the 7th Battalion. Well, the next day I fly into Wau, a place, if you'd see it on the map of New Guinea, right in the heart of New Guinea, with the 7th Battalion. And they looked at me as a young fella, and I said, Jesus Christ, what are they sending kids out of here now? They'd been crack troops, good from the Middle East, sunburnt and brown as anything. I was with them for quite a while. They captured, just as I got there, they captured Wau. The Japs had just about almost captured the airstrip, the little airstrip. They were on the outskirts of the airstrip when they got there. And then they pushed them back, right back over the mountain to Buna, an Oro Bay, Buna area. But we were sitting up on the mountain looking down on it, but there was only a small group of us. No way in the world could we attack this. There had about 10,000 troops down there. But they were keeping in touch. They were seeing what was going on and observing. And this went on for quite some time. One morning I said to the medical officer, I said, I don't feel too good. And he took me temperature. And he said, Jesus, he said, you're going to get back to the hospital. I think I was just about, as I say, lucky. He panicked. The temperature must have been right over the top. And he said, we've got no natives. About 2.5 days' walk back to Wau. And he said, do you think you can walk back on your own? And I said, I'll make it. Don't worry about that, I'll make it. He said, we can't give you anyone. And we've got no one to, you know, they used to send along fuzzy wuzzies to help you, you know. He said, do you think you can make it? He said, whatever you do, stay on the track. Don't get off the track. It was only a walking track, you know, where they wore the grass with the natives, and a few troops had been over it, one thing and another. And you could see the track, the walking track, in the grass. He said, whatever you do, don't get off the track. Stay on the track. Well, that's all I had to do, was just watch where I was walking. And I walked. But it was warm at night time. It was not like here. And I got back to Wau, and then they sent me from Wau. They couldn't keep me there because they had enough problems on their own with other fellas wounded and one thing and another. And then they sent me to Moresby. And Moresby was worse because they're getting the casualties coming down from the coastal area, which was only about 30 or 40 kilometres north of Port Moresby. But we were right over on the other side. So they woke up, they said, oh, they checked me out. They said, well, send you back to Australia. You pick up and get out of the tropics. And that's how I ended up getting back to Townsville. And from Townsville, Townsville was worse because they had tents everywhere for wounded and dying, and oh goodness.
Len was treated in Melbourne for dengue fever and dysentery. And while recuperating, he met up with an army friend on leave. They went out rabbit shooting. Unfortunately, the friend accidentally shot Len in the hip, resulting in his eventual discharge from the army as medically unfit. However, Len was determined to serve, and that's when he signed on with the US Army small ships and ended up back in the New Guinea region and subsequently on the concrete-hulled supply ship SS Armand Considere at War's End. And from there to Shanghai, and an experience that would cloud Len's memory for 74 years until his recent return. 93-year-old Len's adventures aren't over yet. He's off to the Philippines next week, where he'll revisit wartime memories of Leyte and Corregidor. Way to go, Len. Our thoughts go with you. Come home safely.